I absolutely fell in love with Data on Tap. So all of my comments have everything to do with my love and passion for Data on Tap.
In tech we trust. It's the people in charge we're not sure about.
Welcome, welcome. Episode 40 of the In Tech We Trust podcast. Gabriel, you're back from Cisco Live, though. How are you doing?
I am doing well. Thankfully, this is the first time I've ever been to a trade show or a conference that was only an hour away from my home and in my own time zone for once. So that was nice. Beautiful, wonderful San Diego, nice week of weather, and Aerosmith totally rocked it.
Oh, is that right?
Yes, it was amazing. It was actually really, it was like, perfect. I mean, it was the right mix of songs. It was, you know, I got a picture of it, and I was in this for Cisco Champions. There was a special box, set of box seats, because I'm special, I guess, where we were up above watching the entire thing from up there. And it was just, it was a sea of people. There were probably, I would say, easily 20,000 people in that stadium at Petco Park in San Diego. And it was just, it was a really dynamic, fun show. I had a blast.
I heard it was so good that somebody died.
Yeah, what was the deal with that afterwards?
I don't know if that was a Cisco Live participant or something like that, or somebody got hit by a train. You know, I mean, so, you know, the convention center is right along the train track, and there's a train and then there's a trolley. And, you know, trolley is fairly quiet. Trains are a little bit louder. I mean, I have no idea how it happens, but believe it or not, we get a couple people where I live, which is close to a train track, you know, at least one or two people a year who get hit by trains.
No way.
Yeah, there's it always happens in Palo Alto, of all places, too. Despondent teenagers walk in front of trains, Caltrains and stuff.
No way. That's awful, man.
Yeah, homeless people and despondent teenagers take themselves out in front of in train wrecks.
Yeah. I mean, I think they were talking about it maybe being a homeless guy at Cisco Live. I know that was at least what the early reports were saying, but man. Well, there you go. Anyway, so you're obviously here. Mark, you got anything interesting going on?
Well, let's see. I did actually taste some of my last batch. It was a summertime light time beer, and it is that. It is. I brewed it to be a relatively lower alcohol. I ended up actually adding more malt to it as fermentation was just starting because it was too light. The original gravity was too light, and it's pretty light. So I don't know. It tastes more like soda than beer, I think.
Fair enough.
Disappointing to make 5 gallons of something that, you know, it'll be a nice, light, refreshing drink for if I'm ever out in the desert and have nothing else to drink.
It's the Pinot Grigio of beers.
It's worse than that. It's the white Zinfandel of beer.
Oh. There you go. Speaking of beer, I'm looking at a guy who's avatar on Skype's got a big mug of it right in front of his face. Nick Howell, how you doing, man?
Hey!
Yeah.
How's it going?
Yay!
It does have, that's what that is. It's beer.
I had to get laid off to finally get onto In Tech We Trust.
You see, there you go, yeah. Yeah, we did think about getting you on, didn't we? And we had this whole, do we bring a vendor on? Don't we bring a vendor on? Nick's a great guy. We could bring Nick on. Should we bring Nick on? Should we not?
And then he got laid off.
Get yourself fired. Boom, straight on. Yeah. The curse.
Oh, how's it going, guys?
It's good, yeah.
Oh, superb.
It is going.
Actually, I just got laid off too, actually not long ago.
Yeah, we're going to talk about that in a bit, I hope, yeah.
Yeah.
Hey, so Nick, what's going on with you at the moment?
It has been one of those crazy kind of months. The last few weeks have been, you know, everybody probably thinks I'm sitting around playing video games and just drinking everything. It's probably one of the more stressful times that I've ever had in my life. It's one of those things where you have all of this free time and everything's great and, you know, but at the end of the day, you're stressed out over not having a job. You're stressed out over not having benefits, all of these other things, and your survival instinct just kicks in and I gotta have a job. I gotta go do all of this stuff. I've gotta chase all these leads. And so that's what I've been doing for the past, especially the last couple of weeks. I did take a week or two, to just kind of clear my head and collect my thoughts, find myself, see where I wanted to go, but I got a pretty good idea of that now and starting to do some interviews, entertained quite a few phone calls, but nothing official yet to talk about.
Hey, so what's your household status? Like, are you a married guy with kids or, you know, what's going on?
Oh, no, I'm single, no kids, never married.
Single, no kids. Okay, so you don't have any honeydew things to do. Because otherwise, if you get laid off, right? The thing is that you know your spouse or significant other usually has like 3 months, 3 months of hard labor waiting for you. You know.
Well, I did just get an Amazon Echo Alexa, and she keeps telling me to do stuff. So it could count as a significant other.
Damn, lucky you.
Hey, so aside from getting bored and the stress of it and stuff like that, you know, looking for a new job, you got any irons in the fire, though? You got any really good conversations going on? Anything, I reckon, that excites you?
Sure. I would say that there's four or five that actually really have my attention, if we're whittling them down. Nobody that is kind of standing out for any particular reason. They all have their pros and cons and their pluses and minuses. I recently put up a post earlier this week called The Tiers of Career Opportunity, and it's kind of the journey that I've gone through over the last month or so, but basically breaking down the different levels of where a particular company might be in their journey through their life cycle. So going all the way from tier one to tier four. So I'll say that I'm talking to people in each one of those buckets, from the smallest 20 person or less startup all the way up to some of the bigger tier one vendors. And the opportunities are mostly similar. Evangelism, TME kind of work, just different kinds of verticals and stuff like that.
What would be like your perfect role that you could land?
Have you ever seen the movie Big with Tom Hanks?
Oh, yeah, years ago.
If somebody would pay me to sit around and play with toys and video games and then just tell them what I thought about them. Actually, that kind of sounds like a TME.
Very good. Hey, on a similar topic then, Mark, you've got some employment changes potentially on the horizon. You're going to talk to us about that?
Yes, I start a new gig next Monday.
Look for Mark at the in those McDonald's ads when they have the elderly employee.
Yeah.
Smiling. Yeah. Would you like fries with that? Sorry.
Yeah. That's me. I'm Guy Smiley. And, you know, I've always kind of wanted to go back to food service work, so you never know. That could be it.
Did any of you guys ever work at a McDonald's or anything like that?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, I worked at a restaurant, not a McDonald's, but a restaurant. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, I've waited tables.
Uh-huh.
I worked at a Chinese food restaurant when I was 13.
13?
Yep, washing dishes under the table. And then
doing what else under the table? What else did you under the table?
Hey, I was 13.
I know.
That should answer it for you right there. And then I worked for a pizza place. Like, I made pizzas. So that was my illustrious food services career. I worked at a Cinnabon once. And the tale of my unemployment from Cinnabon is actually quite funny, but we don't need to go into it today.
Really?
Yeah.
Oh, that's a shame.
Stories of unemployment are kind of interesting. Maybe that should be the theme for this week's show.
Yeah. Oh, wow. I'll say this, though. Much like every Israeli citizen has to serve a period of time in the military, I think that everybody should do a six-month stint, either waiting tables or bartending or something like that, just to understand what life is like in the service industry. So that when you go in, you don't rack up a $100 bill and leave somebody a dollar. You know, there's a certain understanding that people that haven't ever worked in the service industry don't have when it comes to things like, and it's mostly concentrated in America. I know the rest of the world doesn't do tipping like we do here, but it's something that you can only be exposed to by working in the service industry like that.
It's prompt service. You know, I mean, it's. And there's a lot humbling working in the food services or even, you know, any kind of public facing job where you're kind of like, you know, you're the beck and call of someone else. I think
food service or hospitality.
Yeah. Hospitality services
or flight attendant.
No, those guys get what they have coming.
Yeah, I don't know. I think that's the same kind of thing, right? You know, it's a pretty thankless job. Once upon a time, many, many years ago, it was glamorous, and now it's just, you know, really? Oof.
Tell us more about your life as a flight attendant, Mark.
Well, I actually never was a flight attendant, but let's see, some of my best friends are.
Hey, anyway, so I worked for 2 years in a Burger King restaurant, and it was like, honestly, it was the worst thing in the world. But I reckon I came out of that thinking, I could have like any job in the world after that, and it would not be as bad as that. So if I can hack 2 years of Burger King, you know what? I reckon I can hack anything.
I would agree with that.
Good for the soul.
Have you heard the controversy of the guy that found the deep fried rat in a bucket of KFC?
Oh no!
It's totally a hoax thing or whatever. Oh. Or KFC is completely saying no. It's just a piece of chicken that looks funny.
Oh
yeah, that's like the Wendy's thumb in the chili,
right?
Some guy brings in a cadaver's thumb. Brings in a thumb from some dead guy, throws it in his chili. Oh my god!
What do you do that for? Are they maybe looking for a lawsuit or something? Get some money out of
Absolutely.
It.
Absolutely.
Hey, so let's crack onto some technology and stuff then. So, a quick one. Well, two things actually from last week's show. So, we talked about Hedvig, the startup that had a couple of series of funding rounds that were very close together.
Yeah, we were kind of cruel to them about that.
We were a bit, yeah. And somebody reached out to us from Hedvig during the week saying, hey, thanks for the coverage and all that, guys. But by the way, the Series A round, they brought the money in like 2 or 3 years ago, but only announced it when the company came out of stealth in March. So, you know, I'll hold my hands up there and say that was me. Crunchbase, all it says is March 2015 and then Series B a couple of months later. Yeah. So there you go. Hedvig.
Same here. I mean, we were mean to them and we should probably apologize a little bit, right?
Yeah, so I'm going to have one of their guys. I've given them my email address. They're going to reach out to me. I'm going to get a bit more information, probably give them a couple of minutes on the show, as in us just talk about them again with a bit of a straighter story, I reckon.
Thanks. Thanks for the coverage.
Yeah.
Hey, you know what they say, any coverage is good coverage.
That's
right?
True. Yeah.
If you're an idiot.
Also, so following on from last week's show, we talked quite a bit about Nutanix as well. Actually, you weren't on, were you, Gabriel? So I don't know if you want to put your penny's worth in here. But Chris Evans kicked off a conversation on LinkedIn, on our LinkedIn group, about where he thinks Nutanix are going with their new, is it XCP platform and Prism and Acropolis and all of that jazz. So if you're interested in getting involved in the discussion there, go across to our LinkedIn group. Gabriel, though, do you have anything that you wanted to say about where you think Nutanix are going?
I paid somewhat limited attention to it because I was involved at Cisco Live the whole week. But, you know, from everything I saw, it was, you know, the big push was, hey, Acropolis is coming out, which is our, you know, our KVM hypervisor that you can leverage through Prism. And then there's all these other things that are going to come later down the road, you know, like erasure coding. And, you know, the last post I read on the erasure coding thing was like, hey, erasure coding is great. It's going to give you better performance or better storage leveraging, but don't use it in production. So, you know, it's a continuing growth of Nutanix. I mean, they one company that, you know, they definitely don't just sit by idly.
Oh, no.
And just let their solution go. They're constantly adding to it. They're constantly improving upon it. So in that series, you know, in that sense, it's very much, you know, onward and upward towards that IPO or acquisition. You know, it's anybody's guess which way that goes. I mean, obviously, a lot of people are talking about the bad blood between them and VMware, and you know, Chuck Hollis had a series of blog posts that. You know, that have made the rounds in different discussion groups and whatnot. And, you know, the timing is obviously interesting given, you know, that, you know, sometimes kicking the hornet's nest can get you some visibility, but then at some point, you know, the bees are going to come out and sting you. And I think that's what you're seeing. I mean, who has a bigger marketing budget? You know, if you want to like continue to poke the bear, sometimes he gets hungry. And, you know, we're kind of seeing that now. And I think the timing is bad for a company who's shopping around to investors. Investment houses, who's going to push forward with an IPO where there's a lot of money at stake. So, you know, I think they've probably done the right thing in being kind of quiet about responding to a lot of the criticisms, that have been labeled at them recently and focusing more on the, you know, the benefits of their platform and the direction and change. You know, by my count, this is kind of like the fifth pivot that they've made, in terms of their marketing message. It'll be, you know, it's up to the market to decide if that's going to resonate with them or not. Personally, I see, you know, I can see the benefit long term of kind of coming out with your own hypervisor, but then I look at every customer I've ever talked to and they're like, yeah, you know, am I going to risk my production environment on something that nobody's running, right? Or that a company with 1,000 people in it is going to support. I think that you'll find that, you know, maybe 5% of or 10%, this is an educated guess on my part, of Nutanix's customers are running KVM or Hyper-V. The vast majority are running VMware, and the reason why is because it's a safe bet.
Hey, Nick, do you have any thoughts on Nutanix? Because we were dishing out the hate last week.
Two things, really. One, I'm pretty sure I'm on record saying that I'm not a fan of linear scale in general. So the whole hyperconverged play for me just doesn't really have a lot of my attention. The other thing that comes to mind for me for Nutanix is, you know, putting aside all of what it is and trying to break down what Acropolis is, I don't really know that I'm sure what Nutanix's IP was before that, other than the platform, the centralized, the way that the box was put together. And I think this was more of a way to differentiate themselves and have something that was a piece of IP that they can take to market, other than a cute box that they put together with some SDS, you know, moving between flash and spinning disk inside of it. That's kind of my take on it. As far as the controversy between them and VMware, apples and oranges, as far as I'm concerned. You've got a huge customer base that still constitutes, I believe, 80% or more of the market share of the hypervisor market. And I just don't think that's going to go away anytime soon, regardless of the pricing concerns, regardless of that. It's not going to turn around anytime soon for them. I wish Nutanix all the best of luck. We've got a lot of friends over there, and I think they're doing some really cool stuff. But I just don't think it's in the majority interest of the industry, frankly.
And frankly, the total, I mean, not the TAM, but, you know, the market for hyperconverged has been growing, but it's been kind of growing slowly, not to the point where, like, we're world beaters, right? So for all the talk of, you know, taking out VBlock and FlexPod and the other converged infrastructure players out there, where their run rate business on an annual is close to, what, $4 billion? The combined hyperconverged market still hasn't eclipsed $1 billion worldwide.
I hear everybody talking about it. I don't see anybody actually implementing it in the enterprise.
They are implementing it, but it's for point solutions or specific instances. Like, obviously VDI tends to be the big strong play because in VDI instances, I think there's a lot of value in a linear scalability in terms of compute and storage, as long as those two are matched up properly. Right. And I think you can fine tune a Nutanix platform based on the plethora of options that are available inside their solution to do that. Mm-hmm. But, am I going to replace my entire tier one infrastructure with it? I don't care how many times you show me, a synthetic workload that you've tested against it. I know that there are guarantees that other solutions can give me that are much more flexible in the ability for me to scale resources independently. And that's what I'm looking for in that particular instance. Or they've been around for 20 plus years. And, that speaks volumes for my, mission critical stuff. Now, if I'm an IT company or if I'm an IT shop with, say, less than 7 people for the entirety, and my annual IT budget is, $300K, well, I'll tell you, hyperconverged is like the way I would be definitely going.
Yeah. Well, I would also say make sure you're doing accurate pricing comparisons as well when you're converting from what has been a traditional SAN or NAS enterprise array or a layout like that with first class enterprise array features, regardless of what the vendor is, to something that's hyperconverged. Make sure that you're comparing apples to apples there when you're going from capacity, performance, and space efficiencies going from one to the other there, because a lot of the times it doesn't translate exactly as you would think it would. And you're going to end up spending as much, if not more, trying to make that stuff work in a hyperconverged solution.
I imagine as well that's not an easy thing for a lot of IT departments to do, considering they're understaffed, they've got more work on than ever, and then they've got to try and do that kind of apples for apples comparison you're saying there, and then throw in, well, what impact does it have on staffing and training and team structure and all that kind of stuff? It's a big old change to make to jump into that kind of mindset, I think, of buying that hyper-converged.
Here's a question on it. What if you're building out some sort of greenfield application? Are there any advantages to doing this than going a traditional route?
Sure. I mean, the test dev I know Gabe was talking about the VDI space, but test dev has been, if you go back to 10, 20 years, the coming up of the virtualization space, the VMware space, was all about test dev. That's where it all kind of started. And even before that, it was doing workstation on laptops, test dev and demos and POCs and stuff.
No, but I'm talking about hyperconverged storage systems, and sure, they're not just storage, but that's really what we're talking about here is a storage platform that they're trying to build, right? What's the advantage? Is it just test dev? Is that it?
I think it's simplicity of deployment. I mean, that tends to be the strongest message that a hyperconverged is like, hey, up and running in an hour, easy. You don't need to get the IT org involved completely to manage it. You know, anybody who could use VMware or, you know, can look through this GUI and see it. I mean, it's reduction of sophistication, and that's why I think it's also a platform that is more affluent towards unsophisticated organizations. The more complex the workloads, the more complex the, you know, the workflow and the scalability and all those other things, you know, the more specialized the solution tends to get. And, you know, it's, you know, if you look at how engineered something like a VBlock is compared to, and like I said, the diversity of workloads and the type of customers who buys that particular solution versus somebody who buys something like a Nutanix or SimpliVity, you can see why one is a $2 billion company and the others are, as a market entirety, just knocking on $1 billion.
Hey, on the Nutanix specifically though, right, do many customers deploy multiple apps on a single Nutanix cluster? Or are
I
they
pretty? So, yeah.
Really? Because yeah. I get the impression that people will buy it for, like we said earlier, VDI, or like what Mark was maybe suggesting there, you know, a greenfield, a new app would go on it. But are many people saying, right, we're going to throw a bunch of different mixed workloads onto these Nutanix systems?
You know, my experience in selling, you know, SimpliVity, and I would expect the same from the people at Nutanix, is that, you know, a lot of organizations that kind of fit that smaller IT mold, we're putting their entire IT infrastructure on it as much as possible. If it was virtualized, and let's get straight here, this is a 100% virtualized platform. If it was a virtualized workload, then they were throwing it on there. I mean, I had more than I had. My best cases were like ones where I would come in and it was some shop with, you know, 40 physical servers who had yet to do anything in virtualization, and I'm like, I'm going to reduce those four racks into 4U. How's that?
And like, I totally get that for those small companies. I think what I was really thinking was maybe a company that's got, I don't know, right, ballpark like 1,000 servers or something like that, and they've got 3 or 4 different storage arrays and, you know, more of a medium-sized business. The only ones that I've talked to that are that kind of a size would deploy a Nutanix or, you know, similar solutions for a particular app or for a particular business unit and not share it across multiple.
I definitely think it could be used for the low-hanging fruit general-purpose virtualization. I mean, a large majority of actual VMs inside of your typical, you know, let's just take a VMware data center, like you said, 1,000 VMs, a large majority of those are going to be just general-purpose Windows or Linux hosts, infrastructure management kind of stuff that is low utilization, low stuff. I could absolutely see a consolidation effort coming in to minimize the number of hosts, the amount of storage, and like you said, the amount of rack space used. To consolidate a lot of that and save your big boy stuff for your specific tier one apps and things of that nature that Mark was alluding to. I don't know if I would see vice versa.
It's very much like the very beginnings of virtualization, and this is from an infrastructure standpoint. You know, we put the print server on there, we put the DNS server on there, we put the low-hanging fruit, but we weren't going to put our Oracle rack on there.
And therefore, do you think in the future people will?
Well, not never Oracle. but you know, there are workloads. I mean, like, let's say Exchange for case. I know that Josh Odgers has worked very hard to validate the Exchange platform on the Nutanix system, and I think there's a lot of customers who say, yeah, we might entertain putting it onto a hyperconverged solution. And that's, you know, email tends to be a tier one app in a lot of organizations. You know, but am I going to take my 50,000 user Exchange environment, put it on there versus my 500 user Exchange environment?
Well, enough love for Nutanix this week. We gave them the hate last week. That is definitely enough love. Let's switch on to tech news from this previous week. And you know what? There's not a great deal. So I've only got 3 items. I'll run through them real quick and then we'll go back and see if we think any of them are of interest. Violin, right? I mean, are those guys even still in business? I don't know. But they've got a new SVP of worldwide sales who's been talking about the death of disk drives, right? I know, totally boring, okay. But I think I'd maybe like to come back and see what your guys' opinions are on that and what you're seeing out there in data centers in the real world. Item number 2, though, again, bit of a meh. VMware doubles the number of VMs that Evo Rail Solutions can support. I'm saying it's a bit of a meh. It is for me, but maybe that's a big thing. And last but not least, Veeam are going to be adding cloud replication for service providers so that they can offer like DR as a service, which I don't know. You know, we've talked about backup on quite a few of the podcasts recently, what's usually a pretty boring topic. I don't know if that's potentially going to be interesting. So can we just jump straight back to the violin one first? Oh, it's not really violin, but just the whole idea that one day the disk drive is going to be dead in the data center. I really don't want us to flog this to death, okay? But are you guys seeing any evidence of that out there in customers and in real-world data centers that, you know, flash is really starting to squeeze the disk drive into the corner and closer towards the exit door?
Not yet. The future is promising.
I mean, I can speak on my behalf, but, you know, and not that I'm speaking for any particular company.
Oh, yeah. There you go.
But I will say, though, that I'm seeing a lot of traction for specific tiers of customers where flash is going to become the first choice of storage medium for, you know, a class of workload, right? You know, spinning disk is not going away. It's cheap. You know, think about it this way. I'm not going to put my backups on a flash medium. Unless there's some kind of weird use case where, you know, the performance afforded requires it. But I will put, you know, a lot of my transactional stuff on there. I will put my VDI on there. I will put my multi-tenant workloads on there that need to scale rapidly or have, you know, a performance profile that fits that. But, you know, I mean, especially coming from a company that, you know, had a 33% hit reduction in their sales last quarter, and who has a flash medium that's proprietary for all intents and purposes. You know, it's somebody who's new trying to make a splash. I think Violin goes the way of Nimbus Data and a few others that are out there.
Yeah. I think you're probably right there. Do you think, though, we're getting to the point where, I don't know, flash is the de facto choice for all tier one transactional type workloads, and the days of a high performance spinning disk based tier one solution are really on the way out?
It's a combination of evolution and revolution. I mean, if you go back, how much SCSI disk do you see around anymore? Probably not. It's all SAS and SATA.
Yeah.
And
no more fiber channel.
Yeah, right.
For all intents
exactly.
And purposes, though, SAS replaced SCSI.
Yeah, it did. Yeah.
So I guess my point is that IT has a long story of history repeating. So I think we're going to see something that's better than flash come out, and flash will take over that middle tier at some point. I think you'll always have that cheap and deep option of big 7200 or faster 4 terabyte plus spinning disks for the long-term archiving, stuff like that. But is flash going to be the end-all be-all of everything? No. I do think we're going to see something, whether it's RAID 3D with larger capacities or whether it's DRAM getting into more high performance than what flash delivers today. I think that the story's not done yet. Flash is not the end. But yeah, I'd say hang on to that for just a minute.
Yeah, so tape still is dead. We should probably change the discussion to memory-based storage as opposed to just saying flash. I think when we say flash, you know, we throw a lot of things in there. There's going to be memory-based storage. I think the answer to your question, Nigel, is yes. I think we're at that point where tier one storage is actually everybody's getting. And you wouldn't say today that everybody's doing that, but I think we've hit the tipping point. I think we're past it. I think most people understand that if you want to get performance out of your storage, you got to put it on flash, because if nothing else, the aerial densities that everybody's pushing on disk drives makes it impossible to get performance out of disk, right? The disk manufacturers themselves have made their products mostly inappropriate for high-speed transaction processing because you have too much data on one spindle.
Totally, yeah.
Not only that, so, it's like there's certain workloads where disk is going to actually perform better. You know, streaming media to something, you know, to capture that is going to work much better. Our backups are going to work much better. There are certain types of workloads where even putting rotational disk inside the server itself for some specific types of logging and whatnot is going to outperform, you know, flash in certain instances.
Yeah, I'm not arguing with you, Gabriel. I think your point you made earlier about, you know, workloads going that way are absolutely right on in what you're talking about, you know, streaming media, secondary media or whatever. You know, I think, you know, spinning disks, spinning rust makes a lot of sense.
Right. And also a lot of the, you know, I mean, let's face it, most of the high performance, you know, NAND, you know, memory based technologies, use your terminology, are leveraging things right now like deduplication and compression and thin provisioning and whatnot to get around the limitations of cost within the flash space. And then, you know, as those densities, as you know, it gets, as that scales, And as the size of those discs scales and the prices come down, they will slowly replace, you know, the spinning disc that we would naturally gravitate to. I mean, honestly, I couldn't imagine for the life of me somebody building a storage array with the new 10 terabyte spinning discs in some kind of RAID format.
Those shingle discs, yeah.
It's like, you want to talk about, you know, rebuild forever. All right, go have a nap there, Rip Van Winkle. You can come back and the array's done fixing itself. You know, I just, there's certain things where I just cannot picture that. But then, you know, it being a general purpose commodity solution, except for, you know, hey, I want to store every picture I've ever taken since the dawn of time on my, you know, my home Synology.
I think we should all have some universal erasure code that runs through all our home photo libraries, so we can have our little bits of photos on everybody's machine.
Oh, yeah.
For all the discussion of, you know, disk being dead, tape is still around, and it's not going away anytime soon.
No, so, you know, kind of on that topic, I've got two monitors in the office here, and they're stacked on top of four books. And just by chance, one of those books happens to be called Storage Networking Fundamentals by somebody called Mark Farley.
is your monitor taped to that book?
Anyway, so it was published in 2005, and just a glance at the contents... Flash memory, and sorry, Mark, this is like no reflection on you as a...
Yeah, right, sure, I can see this coming already.
No, but there's no mention of flash in there, and there's no mention of flash in the appendix either, or the glossary. So within the space of 10 years, flash has like massively come on leaps and bounds, right? And my question was going to be, if you were to write a book in 10 years' time, Mark, in 2025, if you're still alive...
The beer is a preservative.
Not working at McDonald's. Would we still be talking about the disk drive in a book? And I think you've probably just answered the question already there, Gabriel, by saying, you know, the tape isn't going away and the disk isn't going away. It's just going to be that, like, proper low tier, throw your backups at it, throw anything that you don't need to update at it, anything that's just sequential, maybe read-only, all that kind of stuff, yeah?
I don't know. Nobody would pay me to write a book, so...
You know, the thing about that book, right, is at the time that was written and my previous book, Building Storage Networks, were written, there were a lot of people that didn't understand storage and understand disk drives.
Oh, yeah.
And RAID and all of that stuff, right? So, the books were written to be educational so people could understand it. You wouldn't even have to write at that level anymore, you know, in 10 years from now, or probably not even today. Mm-hmm. You would be writing about different kinds of workloads, and you might try to inform people a little bit about the devices that are underneath it. But for the most part, the device stuff is going to be masked by higher level stuff. And not that it wasn't then, but it, you know, look, even 5 years ago, buying a big VMAX or 3PAR array, you know, you actually had to know a lot about disk drives to figure out how you were going to get all your workloads working on these things.
Oh, right? Yeah.
And with flash removes a lot of that, right? You just say, you know what, we're going to go with transaction high speed stuff. It's going to be in flash, and you're going to need to know things about that, but not to the same level where you had to actually figure out how many IOs per spindle and how many channels did you have going and how do you spread the workload across all your spindles in the box. You don't even have to think about that stuff anymore with memory based storage.
Yeah, weren't they the bad old days when you think about it like that? Good grief, it's like archaic.
They were glorious days for people, you know, for administrators.
Got paid a lot, yeah. I mean, mm-hmm. I totally remember that. But good grief, I would not want to go back to those days of trying to map out designs like that. Oh, dear me.
Yeah.
Didn't NetApp buy Spinnaker in 2005?
Something like that. That's probably right. Is that true? Is somebody looking that up right now? Somebody should. I mean, it might be right.
Oh, I think it was before that, wasn't it? 2003?
It was 2003.
Whoa.
Yeah, that's a long time ago, yeah.
Well, hey, let's talk about the giant 800-pound elephant in the room, if you guys want to.
So my first question on that would be, why the hell did it take so long?
I have no idea. I honestly have no idea.
Bad answer.
And you know,
they bought that before Nick was born, so...
Yeah. Right. Wah, wah.
I mean, the thing is, everybody tends to think that it's because ONTAP is a dinosaur, right? And it's so hard to...
So do you guys, from what I've heard, right?
Yeah, that's right, yeah.
Yeah, so don't say everybody else, right?
Yeah.
So let's talk about that, right? Because I've always wanted the chance to talk about it, and now in an interesting way, I can. So ONTAP has been around for a long time, and there's a reason that it's been around for a long time, because it's good, and it works. And this idea that it's long in the tooth or it's just not good anymore is... is short-sighted. That's not, you're just not paying attention. It is fantastic. I mean, it's one of the, some of the best things that are going on at NetApp are the engineering that's based around Data ONTAP. The distraction has been the conversion from 7 mode to CDOT. And you could go back and you could fumble and fault the marketing and the way that it, all that was delivered and all kinds of stuff all day long. But to simply point at ONTAP and go, you're old, you don't belong anymore, you don't even get a seat at the table anymore, that's just short-sighted. I mean, some of the top SPC1 numbers came out of the all-flash FAS. That's easily in the top 10. I think it was the fifth place earlier this year. So to snub it is a little bit silly, because it's a powerful platform and it's only going to get better.
There's something to be said for a mature, you know, file system, and that, you know, you see a lot of companies out here coming out with new technologies and it looks awesome on its face, but the proof tends to be in the pudding. I mean, didn't NetApp have something like 750,000 customers or some ungodly number out there?
I'm not sure what that number is, and I don't want to speculate, but I mean, I think it was one of the first log structured file systems. And if you look at some of the newest companies that are coming out today, you know what they're still creating? Yeah. Log structured file systems. So it's not a dead technology. It's that stuff still continues to hold sway for the most part, except in the most extreme special circumstances.
And it does have most of the bugs flattened. I mean, that's the great thing, yeah, about mature code. It's not, you know, the number of customers speaks a lot, but the reason why that's important is because it's been through all the corner cases, or most of the corner cases.
Yeah. Well, the funny thing is, if you ask most customers about that have been using NetApp for some time, they absolutely love the storage system. They absolutely love ONTAP. Where they run into problems is a lot of the auxiliary stuff, the snap managers, the auxiliary software, system manager could be better, those sorts of things. That's the kind of feedback you hear, and that was the feedback that, you know, NetApp always took on board as part of the product development. So it's nothing to do specifically with ONTAP. So don't be careful of pointing fingers directly at ONTAP.
But surely, Nick, there comes a point, like, I get all of this about it being, you know, it's rock solid, it's ironed out all the bugs and all that kind of stuff, but there must come a point where, and it's not the number of years old that it is, but it's the fact that it's got so much hanging off of it and on top of it and all of that kind of stuff that it becomes really difficult to innovate on it. Like, surely you get to the point where you daren't change some of that fundamental underlying code in case you break 10 layers that are sat on top of it, right?
They did, and they called it clustered data on tap. The command line function is all new. The way that disks are handled was all new. The way that the cluster backbone worked was, all new. New compared to 7 mode. Different.
That then negates the idea that it's got all the bugs ironed out and it's old mature code and stuff like that. If you're basically saying you've rewritten it all, then again, is it not just some kind of new system that customers shouldn't trust?
Sure. I mean, and we could rewind the clock 5 years and relaunch it as a completely different named product that wasn't that. The fundamentals of the way the storage system is managed at the brick layer, at the foundational layer, are the same. The all of those carry forward. The layers above that are different. The way the commands work, the commands structure themselves, and a lot of those other the clustering backbone technologies.
Hey, would it have been a good idea to have just released Spinnaker as a separate product?
Are you asking me if I was CEO, would I have done it differently?
Yes, that's exactly what I'm asking you. There you go.
Yes.
That's really fair.
Oh, no, that's really good, Nick. Did you say yes there?
I did say yes. I would have pitched it as a competing product to Isilon.
Again, that was going to be my very next question, because that would have made it a much more natural
competitor.
And you're right, there's not.
Call me, NetApp. I'm available. I hear you guys are searching for a CEO.
Actually, if they had the vision to have seen it, it would have preceded Isilon by several years, and it would have been the first to market for that big object storage space.
Look, here's what happened. I've told this story several times, and I can get it out in 60 seconds now. Go back to 2011. We knew that as TMEs that we knew what was coming. We knew that there were going to be shortcomings as far as feature parity and things of that nature. And we knew that sometime in 2014 or beyond was going to be the mecha moment when everything was at parity and everything. We knew that that was going to be a struggle. What we didn't anticipate was the lack of customer adoption. And if you look at a lot of the things that have happened over the last 4 or 5 years to NetApp, you could tie it all back into that. had customers just jumped on board and said, yeah, throw caution to the wind, let's go for it, we'd be having a completely different conversation right now.
Isilon.
Yeah.
Oh, they did. They bought a lot of Isilon. That's a big business for EMC.
Yeah. New media, especially here. I'm in LA. They love it.
Oh, yeah. No, it's all over the place.
It's not just new media.
Well, it's also why, you know, I was following with great interest the stuff at Cumulo. Like, you know, it's going to be Isilon 2.0 in a certain respect.
Good example.
I will be very interested to see how much penetration and how quickly that organization ramps. I mean, you know, they're coming out of stealth with over 100 employees, very well funded, and a product that you know, kind of has a pedigree of development that will be very interesting to watch.
True to that. It'll be interesting.
And I was not paid by Cumulo for that.
No. No, in fact, you could say that it, to some degree, or even work at a competitor, although pretty distant.
Yeah.
Yeah. And even in that vein, going back to everything that I just had to say about NetApp, look at, before I was an employee of NetApp, I was a customer of NetApp for 5 years. I absolutely fell in love with Data ONTAP. So all of my comments have everything to do with my love and passion for Data ONTAP as a platform and as a system, regardless of how, you know, NetApp handled it from a marketing standpoint. That platform is for real. It's mature. It has been tested to the wazoo and back. Just don't sell it so short, because now they've got all flash FAS. Now they've got a specific build of ONTAP that runs all flash stuff. So all flash FAS personality. Oh, come on.
So why are their numbers hurting? Why is that?
Because there's a lot more competition.
Well, I mean, that's one thing, sure. The numbers themselves.
There are a lot of choices that customers have out there. There's, you know, we could spend, you know, we could go through the alphabet of all the different companies out there that have competing solutions that are cheaper, or, a lot of companies or a lot of organizations can rest on their laurels and get a little lazy, you know. Large sales organizations, you know, large partner engagement, smaller margins. I'll tell you right now, if I'm a new company coming out, I can offer a partner 35 points of margin versus maybe 5 with a more established organization. You're going to get somebody who's going to sell some of that, and it's going to start to penetrate, and it's going to start to eat into that business over time. If you look at any, of the IDC charts and whatnot, other is like number 2. You know, and that encompasses a large swath of smaller organizations that are hungry and well-funded in many respects.
Yeah, but
so everybody loses market share.
I think you roll the clock back 3-4 years, whatever, right, when all of this, the business difficulties really became most evident. You know, at that time, if you're a startup, it's like, can you really get that kind of money to go after incumbents? And I'll put EMC in there also. Can you really do that to go after incumbents? Are people going to fund that when other, you know, when in fact NetApp has such strong customer loyalty, you know, and all this stuff, right? I mean, something happened, and I agree that ONTAP actually was a terrific platform, and NetApp rode that for, you know, a good 20 years, right? If you go back to the early 90s when that was conceived by, you know, Hitz and Lau and those guys, they really had a great concept, and they did ride it for a long time. But I hear what you're saying, Nick, but there's something wrong there too, right? And I don't know if it's business execution, if it's lack of flexibility of the technology or what, but it's lost its shine in the eyes of many customers.
For legal reasons, there are certain things I have to take to my grave, and I'll say it has absolutely nothing to do with Data ONTAP, but I'll have to leave it right there.
I'll go along with that.
And that's awesome, you know. I think that's really cool that it's not down to the technology there, that you really got that belief in the tech still. That's pretty
cool. Absolutely. I still have simulators that I run at home that I play with.
Oh, now that's a bit sad.
No.
Okay.
Well, those are fun. But, I mean, I will say, like, and I've probably been making this point for like a decade now, you know, that in my view, very much NetApp is kind of the BlackBerry of storage. You know, there's certain aspects of the market that they were just slow to pursue. And in that case, it's eaten into their market share. Now, is it as dire as it is BlackBerry? Did they go from 80% of the market to 3 or 5 or whatever it is? No. But, you know, there are parallels that you can draw from that. I mean, in many respects, the best technology doesn't always win, you know, and it could just be the way customers are looking at the market and the options that they have.
In that respect, let's talk about what I can talk about. Let's talk about EMC.
Yeah, okay, that's fair. No, that's very fair. Let's do that.
No, so, let's go for it.
And maybe without me actually explicitly saying them, you can make some correlations and put two and two together. So if you look at the stark difference that is, you know, if you look at the basic market share numbers, it's about 60%, I think, combined between EMC and NetApp. I don't know if that's fluctuated in the last year or so, but for the longest time, it's been about 30% and 25-ish percent. And then everybody else is kind of in the 10%-ish and down. So that those are the two that you really have to look at. And where are the gaps that those two aren't addressing that are allowing these new companies to fire up constantly? And if you look at each one of those and what they're doing, you can also almost see an exact acquisition by EMC to try and bolt on or pick up another company to spin up something that's also addressing one of those gaps. So I believe, it's my opinion, that NetApp did the opposite, and instead of acquiring, built in some of that stuff themselves. You've seen them come out with deduplication, the inline zero elimination, a lot of those things that have been just organically built into Data ONTAP instead of going out and buying some appliance that gets API bolted into whatever your VMAX or whatever other system is sitting in front of it. And it's just different approaches, different strokes for different folks. But if you look at the sheer portfolio at EMC now, how in the hell does anybody keep up with what is going on over there? And I have no idea. And I'm not knocking them. They have spread themselves so thin.
That's true. I mean, and it's like you have products that compete against each other, and there's a certain amount of cannibalization. But I also think if you look at kind of some of their longer-term strategy, they're hedging their bets against some of the technologies that they have becoming, you know, leaders are lost, you know, losing out. Look at VMAX, right? There's incremental advancements in the VMAX platform. Where did Pure gain a lot of benefit or a lot of entrenchment when they first came to market was those tier one hot workloads that people were putting on VMAX because of the sheer, you know, I mean, for all, you know, it's a damn mainframe that runs storage, right? I mean, it's going to give you the kind of performance that you're looking for in stability. And then, you know, that's a marketplace where it went from something like, what, 18 billion or 22 billion down to 14. Yep. So how do you address that space? You buy Extreme.io, you buy DSSD. I think what you're seeing, and then you start to switch some of your portfolio towards a different operational model, right? So it's, for me, EMC is an interesting animal to look at because I think that they plan out a little bit longer in terms of the execution and deliverable aspects of some of the platforms that they buy. Whereas, and I've seen a lot of other organizations buy something and put it out way early and have it fall on its face, or wait too long and have it be technology that's been eclipsed.
Yeah. I don't know, Gabe. I'd like to alter that interpretation a little bit, which is EMC is very opportunistic. And when they buy something, they turn it into its own product and they don't have to integrate it in. And I think NetApp's failure was trying to think that they had to integrate everything under a platform. Right. And you look at how EMC has bought and acquired all these different technologies. Yeah, they bring them out, they sell them. And if they're successful, they're great. I mean, they do amazing things. You know, they bought FilePool for a song. They turned it into what? Centera. They made a bunch of money off Centera for a while. You know, the Data Domain. They just ran with Data Domain. They didn't like try to integrate it in with everything else. It was its own separate product line. Yeah, right.
They sold a ton of it.
There's great.
But then look what they did with Object, with Atmos, and some of these other products where they've kind of failed and they've kind of slowly disappeared, right?
Yeah. So those things have disappeared, sure. You know, but you look at Isilon. Isilon's a big product line for them. I mean, they didn't try to make it all work together. And you know, we've talked. You know, there's been a lot of discussion of that over the years. From a business execution mode, it should be quite clear. You know, if you're running a class in business, that's the way to do it in technology.
Okay, sure. But is it safe to say, would you agree that leading up to the 2010-ish, 2011 mark, that NetApp was mostly successful because of their unified, multi-protocol, single-platform message that resonated really, really strong with data center administrators?
I did not think so. And the reason I didn't was because I was at Equalogic and I was aware of what was going on at Equalogic, and I was aware of NetApp's private bidding because Equalogic was a private company. There was a little bit of a bidding war going on there, and NetApp was involved and decided not to go for it. And it was, I'll tell you, I was disappointed it didn't go that way. You know, we ended up being purchased by Dell. And I thought we would have been a lot better off being purchased by NetApp. But when you look at how Spinnaker turned out, it's kind of like, you know, I think if they had just ran with it as a separate product, it might have been too early. You know, it might not have been able to penetrate. And, yeah, there would have been some cannibalization, but I think they would have had expansion. And there's been many times I thought NetApp actually could have used different product lines. Like if NetApp had actually won the bidding war with EMC for data domain, what would they have done? Would they have tried to integrate it in, or would they have run with it as a separate product?
Well, you're seeing what they're doing with AltaVault now, right?
No, I don't know what AltaVault
is. Oh, it's the renamed SteelStore Bricks.
It's the
Riverbed acquisition.
The Riverbed stuff, yeah.
Yeah, it's a similar concept in the way it handles things. But guys, if listeners don't fault me on that, I know it's apples and oranges, but the concepts and the fundamentals are the same. So you asked how it would go. It would go kind of like that. Plus, you know, throw in the cloud play that NetApp has essentially bet the company on. So there's all those kinds of things.
Very questionable.
Yeah, but I think there's also an interesting aspect here that we're not taking into account is the continuity of leadership and that strong single presence. You know, Joe Tucci has been at the helm for how many years now? And he's basically stamped his strategy, and it's been successful for the most part. I mean, I can't say it's a failure at any level versus, you know, changing the guard at some of the other storage companies that are out there.
The transition from Wormenhoven to Georgians has been interesting to watch. And now that's run its course.
Yep.
Right. And so, you know, I mean, that affects the stock price. It affects the leadership. It affects the corporate culture and the direction. And in some instances, you know, you see, let's make the Cisco parallel as well. John Chambers at 20 years at Cisco and building it to where it is now, and now being able to turn it over to Chuck Robbins and going to see what happens with that. You know, that's an inflection point, or that's a challenge point where, you know, a company of that size and that scope, it is a complete unknown, you know, what's going to happen, what direction they're going to go at. And you see that happen when you have a very large organization, in my viewpoint, that goes from, you know, somebody who's built and kind of run with the company for a number of years to somebody new and coming in to try to make their stamp. And, you know, there's sometimes incompatibilities there or challenges that are just insurmountable, especially for a mature organization.
It was very interesting when Tucci took over. Nobody gave him any lick of credit for being able to do what he's done. I mean, in advance, right? Mike Rutgers was one of the most popular CEOs on Wall Street for how well he had done with EMC. Rutgers, everybody thought Rutgers was a rock star. And Tucci, I think, has outclipsed him by a long shot with his acquisition strategy. Really incredible.
Hey, Mark, I don't suppose by any chance you would know when you were at Equalogic then what NetApp's plans, at least had they won the bidding war for Equalogic, what would they have done with it? Would they have run it as a separate product line? Would they have integrated it? Do you have any clue?
I have no idea, but, you know, NetApp was already, I think they were already doing things with iSCSI. I assume they would have run it as a separate product line.
Okay. What was your reasoning for preferring that NetApp would have won it over Dell?
Because I actually really like NetApp management. I thought Wormenhoven was a terrific CEO and was really doing a good job. And NetApp, more than any other company at the time, understood customer loyalty. There was no vendor at the time that had customers. You know, there were many startups. You know, we talked earlier about, you know, new startups coming in and replacing the incumbents. I mean, when you go back over the last 10, 12 years, how many startups started that said, we're going to take away NetApp's business, and how many of them failed? I mean, for the first 8 to 10 years of that, they all failed, and none of them got it. I mean, NetApp just crushed every newcomer that came along. Something happened there, but that customer loyalty was incredible. And it would have been a lot of fun, I think, to have been in a company that had that kind of traction with customers. NetApp was a killer back then. They were a great company. They really understood how to run their business. They really understood how to satisfy customers. And it would have been fun to have done that.
I would almost say it does the exact – we're going through almost the new era or the new version of that now. We've got a whole new generation of admins and practitioners in the data centers. We've got a new – CEO, whether he's interim or not, to be determined. Haven't heard any other announcements around that. They've got a renewed focus to really deliver. So I think we're getting ready to see potentially a resurgence of that. And I think a lot of it's going to have to do with the marketing, frankly. I don't think it's to do with data on tap.
I'd like to see it. I'm not going to hold my breath, though. I think they're an entirely different beast these days as an organization. Anyway, let's just rattle through some business news from the week then. So, again, I've just got three items here. So a company that I really like, actually, I think we talked about them a while ago, called Rancher. they actually announced the company this week, plus a $10 million Series A round of funding. Then Cohesity, another interestingly named storage stock. Yeah. Anyway, they've emerged from stealth, but these guys have got like a tidy $70 million in the bank. So they've had like a Series A and a Series B. And I think just from a quick look at them, they're looking to solve the woes of secondary storage, like the sprawling wastelands of everything that isn't what we talked about before, of those kind of tier one transactional workloads that deserve an all-flash array. And they're trying to tackle that secondary storage market that's...
the sea of crap.
Yeah, absolutely. Oh, no, no doubt. Yeah. Maybe we'll talk about these in a minute. And then the last thing, Microsoft have been ringing the changes... can't speak. Yeah, they've been changing things at the executive level. Anyway, Cohesity. Gabriel, why did you laugh at the name?
Because, I mean, I thought Simplivity was a bad name.
Uh-huh.
All I can think of is Cobesity.
Yeah.
Like, 70 million round, they're gobbling up that money.
Yeah, that's lot of money, though.
That's
right?
A lot of money for a, you know, and just out of stealth. You know, it's interesting. You know, the line I read in the platform was like, article that caught my eye was like the most that they had tested was up to 16 nodes because they said, you know, because of a challenge around getting hardware and scaling it up in the lab. And I'm like, man, servers must cost.
Yeah.
That must be some expensive ass server. If you know, you got $70 million, you should be able to at least test your solution up to a 40 to 60 node scale.
Well, you know what? If you're saying they've only tested up to 16, as in 1-6 nodes, yeah?
1-6 nodes.
Well, in the articles that I've been reading around it, they're using terms like infinitely scalable platform. How can you call something infinitely scalable?
Isn't 16 infinite?
Right.
I mean, I know we kind of get annoyed at all the marketing terminology that gets thrown out, you know, out there, but... I mean, seriously, you really can't, I wouldn't have thought, call something infinitely scalable if you've only tested it on 16 nodes. I mean, don't get me wrong, right? So just a bit of background. I think he's the CEO of the company, the founder of the company, whatever. Mohit Aaron, formerly from Google File System Group and also a co-founder and CTO of Nutanix. But on the Google File System side of things, clearly he's done things at scale before. But there's got to be a big difference between saying... theoretically and on paper, our system can scale to infinity and beyond, right? But then saying, yeah, but you know what? Actually, we've only tested it with 16 nodes. Is something not quite right there.
Realistically, I always get curious about scale because, you know, there are reasons why you'd want to scale to, say, infinite nodes. Very few. But, you know, once you start to get past a certain size, you know, you're putting, you know, the classic all your eggs in one basket. You want to create separate disparate failure zones or failure domains in order to protect yourself across groups, right? And, you know, lots of things can make claims about scalability. Show me a customer who's gone past 40 nodes. That's when I start to get interested because once you break a certain number, and it is around that 40 to 50 node range, and I've seen a lot of platforms that are supposed, I mean, they're supposed to scale very well, break down, and all kinds of weird things start to happen once you get past that magic number, 25, you know, 30, 40. I mean, even look at from the VMware standpoint. They just recently got to the point where they could scale past 32 nodes in a cluster.
Mm-hmm.
And that's when things start to, like I said, they start to get a little wobbly. So, I mean, there are a few customers out there, roughly six, that want things to scale infinitely.
Yeah. But they're not buying from these guys, right?
No, they've already
built their own.
Well, and the funny thing is anytime I hear somebody talk about, you know, we built the, you know, we worked, you know, MapR or like Google File System or Cassandra or Zookeeper, all these things, I'm like, you're talking about solutions that Google and Facebook abandoned, you know, 8 years ago, right? It's one thing to point to them. The thing is, the things that Google and Facebook and those types of companies use today, you don't know about. And the only things you do know about are the things that they abandoned or moved off of because they, A, probably couldn't scale.
Yeah.
I'll throw in that you know, I'm looking at the headlines on the front page of their website. And first of all, Cohesity, welcome to the party. The storage world is fun. But if you look at the headlines of some of the stuff, apparently they're reinventing secondary storage. And they're going to shake up storage. You know, just every 2 months, every other month, there's a company that comes out and says they're going to reinvent storage. And, you know, again, going back to the earlier ONTAP discussion, there's something to be said for maturation or maturity in the marketplace like this. But what problem are they solving? Does a problem of scaling to 40 to 50 nodes exist? I don't know.
Here's my thoughts on it, right? As in them wanting to tackle a secondary storage, if they're including things like backups.
Yeah, that's what it is. It's backup, archive, it's DR, it's replication,
DR,
archival.
Doing all of the analytics on it and everything. If you were to have one single platform that was just this big old pool of storage, right, that you could just section off a bit for backups and then have just some still live data on there, but it doesn't need to be on flash or something like that. And then you can run snaps of it and you can run analytics and stuff like that against it. I can see, you know, a lot of medium to large sized companies that could say, you know what, we're probably buying 10, 11, 12 different platforms and solutions out there to cover backup and all those different use cases. What if we were to just throw one out there? Well, you know what, it'd have to be quite big and it'd have to be robust and all that kind of stuff. I don't know. Maybe there's a market for that.
If I only rarely have to actually retrieve the data, you're not going to beat the prices on S3 or, you know, on Glacier.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, I would challenge you to find a CEO of a storage company that only wants the secondary storage business. Of course, though, they want all the storage.
That's a big market, though, you know.
So these guys are more of a competitor with Cumulo than anybody else.
Yes.
Bingo.
Yeah. Yeah,
they want to be scalable. They're going to be cluster, and the integration of analytics will really be the interesting thing, right? Because that's Cumulo's claim to fame, is trying to create additional metadata, and they're doing it by measuring performance for objects and those kinds of things. Who knows what other kinds of metadata they're going to be looking at? What Cohesity looks like they want to do is build a very metadata rich environment where, you know, once the stuff goes in, you can find things in it, which you can't do today. And, you know, if you look, for instance, at Isilon, if you try to find stuff in there, it's really hard. This massive object repository, it's great at holding a lot of stuff, you know, but find anything there, manage it in there, really hard. So I think that, you know, Cohesity is going after this, right? The idea of a Google file system, the idea of anybody from Google is all about search. So what are they building in there so you can search? And in that sense, it's interesting because, you know, this is part of what Rubrik is trying to do with backup data. You know, they're trying to provide a search engine for backup data also. So they kind of overlap there. You know, the tough time here is that you've got to move it out of where it is and onto this platform in order to apply that. And we'll see whether or not they're successful in being able to get people to migrate their, you know, let's face it, let's look at here. Qualcomm Ventures is one of the groups. And by the way, the investors in Cohesity are blue blood investors.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
They've got really strong backing. Now, that's a big plus. It doesn't mean that they're smarter than anybody else, but they tend to be winners. You know, so they've got Qualcomm, Google, Excel, Battery, initially with Sequoia. I mean, these guys have really strong backing, and that helps. Qualcomm, you know, how many petabytes does Qualcomm have? It's a huge environment.
A lot.
It's an enormous environment, right? And so Qualcomm is into this. And Qualcomm, you know, for instance, is one of the largest NetApp customers, you know, on the planet. And, you know, and if they can figure out how to move stuff off of NetApp filers where they can't find anything, where they don't know anything about what's stored on them, and put them in a big scalable environment where they can get that information quickly, you know, they got to seriously look at it.
I'll give a shout out to another similar company called Catalogic that's doing a similar thing where they're not so much providing the storage, but providing a way to index all of the metadata into a search string or into something that you can actually find within your storage. And they partner with several of the storage vendors like NetApp, and I think they've got some interactions with EMC and Dell Storage as well. So I'm wondering if this is a problem that really needs to be solved in today's enterprise IT data center.
Oh,
to the point of large enterprises, it really
needs to be solved.
Yeah. I think data management needs to be solved, right? And that's the problem that I think a lot of organizations have. Hey, you know, I have all this unstructured data that I can't really search. I can't identify what I need to keep. I can't secure properly. I can't understand if it's got, secure information or where it actually all is. being able to put something on top of that that can do the analytic aspect of it, I mean, that's where I see the revalue. I'm not seeing that necessarily in the Cohesity solution. What I'm seeing is a lot of talk about their Snap technology, you know, and I'm like, all right, well, from that particular aspect, this sounds more like scale out data protection without a lot of rich data analytics based on top of it. So, I mean, as with all these companies that we, you know, that pop up like almost weekly these days, I need to actually understand, you know, what their pitch is, and then I can speak a little more intelligently. If it's just a simple scale out platform for unstructured data that you can, you know, do some clever snapping and thin provisioning, dedupe and compression, all those things for density, and do it at a very cheap price point, then, you know, that's a pretty competitive space.
Mohit and even Johnny Chen, the head of engineering, those guys' reputations precede themselves. And I think they're going to do nothing but good things over there. I'm curious to see what comes out of it eventually.
They've got to make a lot of good hires. They need to hire guys like you and me, Nick. What's up?
Speaking of good hires, yeah, go on, Mark.
So Mark gave it a very eloquent pitch about Cohesity. Do you have something to tell us?
I have nothing to tell you. No, I have to tell you that that's not where I'm going.
So where are you going then?
We'll talk about that next week. We have to have a little fun with it next week. No, we have to have some fun with it, where I'm going. You know, we'll figure out how to have a little fun, I think. I don't know. Maybe it'll just be nothing.